It is a great time. Hold your applause, okay? I haven't done anything yet. You like that? Yes, it's a great privilege and a pleasure to be here, especially to talk to all you artists. I love talking to people at Subtle Technologies. That's why I've got the shirt. It's also a pleasure to be an experimentalist among the theorists at the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics. I am not a theorist. There will be a very small number of equations in this talk. I am actually an experimentalist, and from the point of view of an artist, I guess, that means I work with actual materials, and I have a lab, and I build gadgets. And basically, I'm going to show you a few of the gadgets that I have worked on in the last little while, specifically three things. And they're all, in the language of physics, they're all classical nonlinear systems. So there's one limit, which is the quantum limit, and there's the other limits, which is sort of cosmology, and those are the kind of things that they do here at Perimeter. There's another limit, which some people talk about, which is complexity. And complex systems are typically highly nonlinear and self-interacting and difficult to understand, even if you know the basic equations. So we claim we know the basic equations of classical physics. You might think, classical physics, what's there to know? Well, what there is to know is situations where emergent phenomena occur in classical physics. And so I'm going to tell you about something called pattern formation. And in particular, I'm going to show you emergent patterns in purely classical situations, and including some that you can do in your own kitchen if you want to. And I like to show this picture because just before you take a bite out of your... Can we hit the lights down a little more? Is that not going to work? I'm speaking to the...
Yes.
Look at that. Thank you. This is a piece of corn. And you'll notice something a little bit weird about it is that the kernels are all sort of linear along here and all linear there, and then there's this kind of gibbled bit in the middle. During the formation of the corn cob, something called phyllotaxis occurs, which is a kind of mechanical growth process which decides where the kernels are, and every so often it makes a mistake. So this is what's called a phyllotactic defect. And one way to think about it is that this is a spiral with a very long pitch, and this is a spiral with a very long pitch. And right here, they kind of cross over. So this spiral goes and joins that one, and this one goes and joins that one. Or you can think of it the other way, as this one goes up and joins that one, and so on. So just before you bite your next cob of corn, okay, just think, there's pattern formation, okay? So the process by which the corn, establishes where the kernels go is phyllotaxis, which is a pattern-forming process. And the other important thing about it is it's not just a geometrically perfect process, but it's a thing that arises from a dynamical process. And the dynamical process can make mistakes or it can fall off the rails and do interesting things. So the defects are often just as interesting as the pattern itself. So this is a pattern in the jargon of my field, and this is a defect in this pattern. Or you might think of this as the defect and this is the pattern. It doesn't really, there's nothing wrong with this. It tastes just the same as the rest of the corn. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about these three experiments. The first one is something you can try in your kitchen of dribbling syrup. The other one is something you may have experienced while driving, which is called washboard road. And the third one is something I'm sure you've seen, which is an icicle, but I will show you a type of icicle which you've never seen, which is a rotating icicle. Okay, so let me talk about dribbling syrup. First, you're going to do the following experiment. You're going to get some honey or a heavy syrup, and you're going to pour it onto a pancake. And what do you notice when you lift the spoon high? Anyone ever done this experiment? Yes, it coils, okay? So instead of just going smoothly downward, it wraps itself into coils. And the higher you lift it, the faster it goes. Okay, so for extra points, we're going to uniformly translate the pancake under the syrup, okay? So as the pancake moves, we're going to dribble the syrup onto it. Now, we can't use real pancakes because, they're too expensive, so we use a belt. So the movie I'm going to show you is dribbling syrup falling onto a moving belt. At first, the belt will move very quickly, and then as the movie progresses, the belt will slowly slow down, and finally at the end it'll be almost stunned. And of course I had to put some music on this, so this is, it's called Moody Meandering Syrup by some people. So here's the belt, it's about 1 centimeter wide, it's moving very rapidly. In fact, it's going so fast that the syrup is just stretched out. As the belt slows down, there's a sudden transition to what's called meandering, where the syrup wiggles back and forth in this way. And you'll notice that as this belt continues to slow down, the wiggles get bigger and slower. Pretty soon the belt is, the wiggles have reached a very large amplitude, and then something funny will happen. Okay, so there's a sharp belt speed at which a transition occurs between the meandering state and what's called the figure eight state. where the syrup draws on alternate sides of the belt. It draws a little loop. And as the belt speed continues to slow down, the loops get closer together. And then there's another transition, which is less obvious, perhaps. Wait for it. There, now the syrup is coiling in on the same side all the time. And that's sort of the stretched out version of what you saw when you poured your syrup onto the pancake. And if the belt were to stop, then it would just coil, okay? Okay, now I claim this has something to do with art. And here's my proof, okay? This is a painting by a well-known artist by the name of Jackson Pollock. Maybe you've heard of him. It's actually one of his less famous ones, and I think you can see why. It's because I think it almost represents people. There's a person standing there, and there's another one, and there's a kind of a whirl, swirl here. Most of Pollock's more famous artworks are more abstract than this. They cover the plane more regularly with splatters and so on. And I think this must have been when he was practicing or learning the craft of his painting. But this is one of his earlier ones. And if you look very closely in the lower left-hand corner, and you always have to check the lower left-hand corner to see if the signature is there, but it isn't in this case. If you zoom that up, you'll notice that sometimes the dribbling paint made these beautiful meander patterns on the page. And this is exactly the same process as I just showed you with the syrup. If the paint has the right viscosity and it's falling at the right speed and you move your hand at the right speed, you will get this meandering. There's a very nice stretch of meandering there, and here's some coiling over here, and so on. What's actually quite interesting is that somehow Pollock managed to avoid this in almost every other painting. I don't know of a single other one in which these features occur. So in the process of studying how to do his art, he learned how to suppress the instability that I'm going to tell you about. And the claim by some people I've read is that he didn't like this effect and he wanted to suppress it, and so he learned how to make the viscosity of the paint different and so on, so it didn't appear. So anyway, so there's an artistic example for you. Anyway, moving right along, the experiment I'm going to tell you about is called the fluid mechanical sewing machine. I did not invent that name. That name was invented by John Lister at Cambridge, who did some work on this before I did. And what it looks like is this. There's a moving belt, and there's a nozzle. And what's important here is the nozzle has a certain height, and the belt moves at a certain speed, U. And as the belt comes around, it hits a scraper, which takes off the syrup, and the syrup drops into a bucket down here, and the belt comes back smooth. From the language of symmetry, the zero belt speed limit is called O2 symmetry. In other words, it has a symmetry of a rotating circle. As you increase the belt speed, in the jargon, you break or unfold that symmetry. If the belt is going very, very fast, then you get this state where basically the belt is hauling the syrup out of the nozzle, and it's kind of a simple situation where you just saw that straight line. So what's interesting here is that you can controllably break the symmetry of the original instability by changing the belt speed. So then it goes through this sequence of things that I showed you. Here is a more detailed study of what it does. This is the belt speed in centimeters per second. So you see it's going just a few centimeters per second. And this is the nozzle height in centimeters. Below about 2 centimeters, the fluid just kind of makes a uniform puddle at zero belt speed. And at higher, it coils. Everything that's red in this picture is a region where coiling occurs of some kind. Everything that's black up here, I got it this way. Okay. So above all the black symbols and above that line, you have this catenary state where the fluid is just pulled out in the line. Everything that's in the blue region is meandering, and meandering looks like this. Okay, so basically the thing wiggles back and forth and draws a beautiful sine wave on the belt. And everything in the red area is translated coiling, and translated coiling looks like this. So the thing makes a kind of looping pattern. In between, in the green region, is the interesting one, which is called figure 8. And there the fluid makes this funny back and forth motion. And this is why it's called the sewing machine, you see, because it looks sort of like it makes all these stitch patterns. A good way to go completely insane is to try and describe what's going on at higher nozzle heights. As you lift the nozzle past 7 centimeters, it turns out that multiple frequencies come into it, and the belt and the syrup begins to make some very complicated patterns. Everything that's colored blue in this picture is sort of disordered, but it's probably chaotic in some sense. And you actually get double meanders and loops and things that go like one loop and then a half a thing. You get two loops on one side, two loops on the other, and all sorts of things happen. Okay, so just to show you that you can do something with all this complexity, if you study just the simplest thing, which is the transition between straight and meandering, And to do that, all we do is measure the amplitude of this sine wave and its wavelength, what could be simpler, and we measure it as a function of the nozzle speed and the belt height. Belt speed and the nozzle height. Then you get data that looks something like this. This is for a fixed height. This is for when the belt is going fast. You see the amplitude is zero. As I decrease on the red symbols, I hit a special bifurcation point, and then the nozzle, the amplitude grows like up here. And then if I increase the speed again, it drops back down and it rejoins this branch at exactly that position there. And this is very simple behavior. There's no difference between the onset between up going and down going directions. And this is technically known as a forward bifurcation or a hop bifurcation. And it turns out you can fit it or you can understand it from a very, very simple equation. And this, for the physicists in the audience, looks a bit like the onset of superconductivity or something like that. But it's not. It's just the generic equation for a Hopf bifurcation. And what it says is that the amplitude should grow like the square root of the distance from the critical point, right here. So this is exactly analogous to a kind of a tipping point or a critical point you might find in a magnet or at the onset of superconductivity or something like that. It's a very universal kind of behavior. Okay, so what happens is that there is a break in stability at this point. So physically what happens is the straight pulled out solution of the fluid equations is still there. It's just that it's unstable to perturbation. So if the tiniest perturbation away from that will cause it to begin to meander. And that happens at a critical value of the speed, which is really not obvious. To calculate that speed is a really non-obvious thing. So if you ever hear people talking about tipping points or critical points or all that, you can actually produce one of those just by, you know, dribbling syrup from your hand. And if you sort of slow down, you'll see that the syrup begins to meander, and that's a critical transition. So that's what I wanted to tell you about this experiment. There's a whole lot more to say, but what we were doing now, and what's beautiful about this experiment, is that you can control everything. The fluid is not even consumed. You can catch it in a tank and put it back in the top again. You can control the belt speed to fantastic precision. You can lift the nozzle up to, you know, really beautiful high precision. You can automate everything with a computer. So that phase diagram that I showed you a few minutes ago, it had about 1,000 points in it. This is a phase diagram that has tens of thousands or maybe even 100,000 points in it. And that's because it was taken automatically by a computer. Okay, so basically, I can program my computer to explore this parameter space as minutely as I want. And I can zoom in on whatever little transitions go on in that space that I want. And nothing is consumed. The experiment consumes nothing except time. And we're in the time room. Okay, it consumes nothing but time and a little bit of space, about this big. Okay. And so you can kind of explore the details of all these different phases at your leisure, as it were. Okay, so that's the first experiment. You can go home and try that one yourself. Here's one that you probably have tried that you'd rather you didn't have, I suppose. If you're driving along on a gravel road in a car, you will notice in the backcountry that gravel roads refuse to remain flat. They develop these bumps, which are closely spaced, which are called washboard road. And that washboard is the pattern on an old-fashioned thing used to rub clothes on to wash them. And so you might say, well, why does this occur? Well, you can think of it the same way as I just mentioned about the syrup. It's the flat road would remain flat, except that it's unstable to the development of this bumpy pattern. So if a tiny, tiny bump pattern of the right wavelength appears, then it's amplified by the successive motion of many wheels, and eventually it grows up to finite amplitude like this. And then everybody driving down the road experiences this washboarding effect. How many people have experienced this? Lots of people, okay. So when I was doing this experiment at Cambridge in England, I said, I'm going to work on washboard road. And the other Cambridge guy said, oh, what's that? And I told them what it was. And they said, oh, we don't have that in England. Maybe in Scotland. And it's true. Everything's been paved in England for too long for there to be any washboard left. But why is this interesting? It's interesting because the dynamics of a deformable medium with lots of friction, like sand, is actually a very complicated thing to understand. And this phenomenon is actually not very well understood at all. So here's the experiment. Since we're physicists, we can hold the car still and rotate the road, you know, like putting in the light bulb, okay? So what it is a rotating table with a layer of sand on the outside. By the way, this is a dry road phenomenon. It doesn't require water. It occurs on gravel roads or sand, mostly. And it's just a wheel that's rolling along the road. If you roll the wheel very slowly, it turns out that it's like a rolling pin. It smooths out the road. If you roll the wheel faster and faster, there's a critical, guess what, a critical speed above which the washboard sets in, and if you go above that speed, the washboard gets bigger and bigger, and this is far above the onset of washboard. And what you find there is the washboard is sustained. You can't really prevent it. If you smooth the road out again, it will grow back up again. Okay, so here's another movie which shows a little bit washed out. It shows is the onset. So when you roll the wheel around on a very smooth surface, eventually it finds a tiny perturbation, a tiny little wiggle, and it begins to bounce up and down. And eventually it develops into this, which is the wheel bouncing, making full jumps, okay? So when you're driving down the road and you're feeling this bounces, what you're actually doing is hopping. Your wheels are actually leaving the surface of the road constantly. And that's why it's a bad thing that your traction goes down and all that. So in order to study this, we instrumented the angle of the arm of that wheel. Oh, by the way, it doesn't depend on suspension either. A lot of people think it depends completely on their bounciness of the suspension, but all the experiments I'm gonna show you have no suspension at all. Okay, so as the wheel goes around the table, around the circle in this direction, first it just stays flat, and then there's this little threshold where it begins to bounce, and then it develops these ripples which actually travel down the road. One way of understanding this phenomenon without trying to write the equations of granular media, which are very difficult, is to just do what's called molecular dynamics simulations. I don't know if you can see it, but there's a wheel rolling there. This is 20,000 particles whose dynamics is resolved in the computer. It's in two dimensions. And one big particle, which is moving to the right at constant horizontal speed. Vertically, it's just falling freely under gravity, so there's no spring or anything. And what you find is that this reproduces all the basic phenomena of the experiment. After a couple hundred passes or a dozen passes of the wheel, it develops into these bounces, and it bounces along and produces washboard ripples. And we can use this to diagnose some things about the washboard, whether it depends on the grain size and things like that. Okay, so here's an even simpler experiment. We get rid of the wheel, okay? So this is like the Zen version of there's no spring, there's no wheel, there's nothing, okay? All I'm doing I'm just dragging a little paddle around, which we call the plow. I'm just dragging it around the rotating table. Now, this movie requires a little explanation. Here's the plow, and the table is turning in this direction, so it runs under the plow, and this is like the road, okay? But what we're going to do is we're going to take a picture of each table rotation so that in this movie, the table will appear to be stationary, okay? But really, it's rotating in this direction, okay? So we can watch the ripples appear, and they grow, and they slow down, okay? And their wavelength increases. Okay, it's going to repeat in a second here. And then there's these little sort of kinks that move through. Now, the ripples are moving up rotation, and that's equivalent to down the road, okay? The table is rotating this way, and the ripples are rotating up rotation. That means that as we progress, as time progresses, the ripples are moving in the direction of driving. So that's the same direction as I showed you before. Okay, it started again. What you find is it's, again, kind of like a hop bifurcation. There's a sudden onset. As the amplitude grows, the speed slows down and the wavelength increases. The simplest thing you can do is dimensional analysis. You can try and guess how this depends on the basic parameters of the problem. And I won't say too much about this, but basically it goes like the 1/4 power of the mass of the wheel. So you can test this just by changing the mass of the wheel and checking that you get a threshold which just depends on the 1/4 power. You can also see lots of other things. You can get backward traveling ripples. You can get chaotic looking ripples. You can get ripples with all sort of knitting patterns. These are these little defects that are moving through the ripple pattern. And you can get all sorts of different phenomenology. And we understand the onset a little bit, but we don't understand the above onset behavior at all. And in fact, the reason it's difficult is it's very difficult to write down that kind of consistent equations for how the sand is going to move under forces. It's hard, okay? Even, you know, there isn't a good model of sand at all, really. There's a good model of a grain of sand, but there's no good model of, you know, the collective motion of many grains of sand that are interacting by friction. And that's a kind of classic example of how classical physics can produce unexpected behavior because you understand single particles, but you don't understand the collective motions. Okay, finally, I want to tell you about icicles. And the provocative question is, what is the shape of an icicle? And in particular, what is the ideal shape of an icicle? And believe it or not, there's actually a theory that says that an ideal icicle is this shape, okay? What this means is zeta is the distance from the tip divided by some length, and rho is the radius divided by the same length. So basically, what this says is that all icicles are long and pointy, as you already know, but they're all long and pointy in exactly the same way. So if I took a picture of an icicle and, you know, I blew it up and shrunk it down, about changing A, I should be able to overlay it on top of every other icicle, and they should be all self-similar. So this is a kind of a self-similar solution to the equations of motion for the surface of growing ice. And so this is called a Platonic icicle by the authors of this theory. And so the claim is that all, if icicles were all ideal, they'd all have this Platonic shape, which is a kind of carrot shape. It's not a cone. It's not a cylinder. It's a kind of bumpy, bulged carrot thing. Okay, and so this is a provocative question. Are icicles all the same shape? And we set out to answer that question by building an icicle growing machine. Icicles grow very nicely in Toronto for a few months of the year, but for the rest of the time they don't. So we needed a machine. And the machine is nothing but a kind of beer fridge with a gadget in it. And we introduce water at the top. We cool the fridge to below zero. And we warm this funnel so when the water drips off, we take the water out again. And we grow the icicle on a little wooden thing. It looks like a dowel. And now this is tricky. We want the icicle to have every chance to be axisymmetric. In other words, we want it to be the same around its axis. That's what the theory says, but that's actually hard to arrange by dripping water in. So what we do is we rotate the icicle. And this is the same as rotating the meat in your barbecue to make all the sides the same. There's another subtle reason, and that is that it's nice to introduce the water onto the surface of top of the icicle off at a little off-axis position like this. And that guarantees that the water is sprinkled down all sides of the icicle uniformly. Okay, so we give it every chance to be axisymmetric by rotating away, if you like, the other direction. Now, we only rotate the icicle once every 5 minutes, but I'm going to show you movies in which it looks like it's going very fast, okay? But that's because it takes 10 hours to grow an icicle, so the icicle looks like it's spinning, but actually, if you watch the experiment, it's very boring because it takes 5 minutes for the icicle to rotate. Okay, so without further ado, here it is. This is a time-lapse 10-hour movie of a distilled water icicle. So this icicle is being grown out of the pure water. We also stir the air in the box, and I'll come back to that point. Or maybe I won't. But if you stir the air in the box, it turns out to matter. So windy conditions, if you like, or well-ventilated conditions matter. And so if you look closely, you might be able to see the drips falling off the ends occasionally. And the tip actually grows at pretty constant velocity. And the icicle grows in width at a different velocity. And the ratio of those two gives you this kind of characteristic Platonic shape. And at some point, it will get to the bottom and suddenly start again. Okay, so this is 1 second of movie, just 10 minutes of real time. Okay, so is the icicle Platonic? Well, the answer is yes, it is, sometimes. This theory must have something going for it because some icicles are extremely well fit by the theory. So, for example, we grew 100 icicles, and if you take the ones that five that fit the best, that in other words, you give the theory every chance to be right, it turns out that it fits to an uncanny degree. And this fit is almost completely independent of the fit parameter because if you change the fit parameter, it actually just rescales both axes, but it doesn't rescale the picture. So the fact that these things agree to almost perfectly, even in the very best cases, does tell you something, that the icicle really is very close to this magic shape. Other icicles, however, do not fit at all. They're kind of bumpy-shaped things. And why would that be? So the least Platonic icicles are, you know, quite far from the theory. So it's kind of like people, you know. People who are really saintly are really saintly. But other people are not so saintly, as it turns out. So all this proves is that it's possible to be a saint, okay? It doesn't mean that everybody's a saint. What it tells you is that some icicles fit the theory extremely well, and it's not an accident because the fit parameter is almost completely independent. The fit is almost independent of that. So what matters, it turns out, are surprising things like air motion. We thought when we started this experiment that still air would be the best because it turns out that this icicle is the warmest place in the experiment, and it actually produces a very smooth laminar flow due to the warm air around the icicle. The icicle is leaking heat to the surroundings all the time in order to freeze the ice, okay? But if you do that experiment, you make a very nice still conditions and you rotate it very slowly so that everything is nice and steady, you don't get a Platonic icicle at all. You get a monster, okay? You get things with tips all over the place. Okay, you sometimes see these in nature, but not always. So if you watch this for a while, what you'll see is that these little bumps grow, and if any bump continues to have water dripping off of it, it will never stop having water dripping off of it, and it'll continue to grow. So this one will actually grow 3 legs, and you know this doesn't look Platonic at all. So it turns out to make Platonic icicle, you must stir the air. And we do that with a few little fans, which are down here, and we just gently ventilate the air in the box. Not blowing hard, but just mix it so that it's constantly mixed. And if you do that, then the same conditions will produce a single-tipped icicle, which is much more ideal. Okay, each of these tips might look a little bit ideal to you, but, you know, it's a bit hard. The other thing is there's another set of theorists who completely independently have worked on what are called the ripple instability of icicles, and it turns out that real icicles are not smooth on the outside. They grow a kind of Michelin man shape, and so a real icicle has a kind of curvy shape like this, and this is a bit like the washboard road, the bumps in the road. So here's an experiment where we inadvertently made a stalagmite, so there's a large stick of ice that grew up here, and it joined up here. This is not rotating. And as the water comes out, you see it running down the sides here, and you'll see the ripples will grow on the sides here. So another thing we're working on is sorting out when the ripples occur and when they don't and how they move. Symmetry suggests that the icicle ripples need not be stationary because, after all, down is different than up. So there's no reason why the ripples on an icicle need to stand still. As the icicle grows, the ripples actually slowly climb the icicle. That is to say, they grow higher and higher on the icicle. And the proof of that is here. This is a 10-hour growth time, and these are the ripples. And if you look closely, you can see this horizontal line. You can see these lines move upward very slightly. Okay? So as you're walking down the street in the winter, you can see ripply icicles around you. You can comfort yourself with the thought that those ripples are slowly moving upward as the icicle grows, which is a kind of happy, optimistic sort of thing. It also happens to agree with the theory, at least up to the sign. Okay, there were two prominent theories for the growth of ripples on icicles. One said they should go down, and the other one said they should grow up. And this illustrates not something very important about physics, which is that the number of theories is always approximately equal to the number of theorists or greater. Okay, because some theorists like to have more than one theory just to hedge their bets. But it turns out that the leading theorists did predict that the ripples would go up, and they do. And so now we're testing how fast do they go up, and questions like that. Okay, well, I've come to the end, and whenever I give this kind of talk, maybe not to artists, but to scientists, people always say, what are you doing this for? What is the motivation? Why do you care about this? Well, I'll now reveal my motivation, and I will appeal to the great relativist, great scientist Henri Poincaré, who said, the scientist does not study nature because it is useful. He studies it because he delights in it. And he delights in it because it is beautiful, and if nature were not beautiful, it would not be worth knowing, and if nature were not worth knowing, life would not be worth living. And I fully subscribe to this. I'm totally motivated by looking at patterns in nature, and I suppose that's an aesthetic reason, similar to maybe an artist's reason. But I think the science is also interesting, but really what I find interesting is making movies of rotating icicles when, you know, who would have thought of such a thing? Of course, there are all also important applications to all these things. Just think of all the energy we could save if we could just decorate the chocolates by the, you know, the chocolates decorated themselves, okay? There is actually a little cake that you can buy in the United States called a hostess cake, and it does have a coil pattern on the top, and it is decorated by the dynamics of the icing itself, okay? So indeed, this is a real thing, okay? It's probably patented by somebody. They probably violated their patent. And finally, I think there's philosophically interesting questions here. What I've shown you is three completely different systems: the meandering syrup, the ripples that develop and grow on the road, the ripples that develop and grow on the icicles, and they're all completely unrelated to each other, you might say. But they're not, because the basic theoretical way we would approach all three problems is to write what's called an order parameter model. We'd write down a model which had an amplitude and a phase, and because of symmetry, that traveling wave can travel in a certain direction. And so at the level of order parameters or a basic theory of these things, they're all very, very similar to each other. And this is an example of universality in pattern formation. As you walk through the world, you'll see many, many patterns from many, many different systems, but at some level, they all have the same symmetries, they all have the same symmetry breaking, they all have underlying dynamics, which is similar, okay? And they're all due to things like the critical points, and tipping points, and Hopf bifurcations, and all those kind of things. It's very general. So that's called order parameter physics, okay? Now, the irony is that the standard model of particle physics, which is the best measured, best understood, most fundamental theory of physics, which everyone thinks is incomplete, but it's the best we have so far, is also an order parameter of physics. Basically, it's written down based on symmetry arguments almost completely, and it uses symmetry breaking and all of that. And so what's interesting is this sort of fun physics of dribbling syrup actually has connections to things like, you know, the origin of mass and particle physics like that. Any theorists who wish to strike me dead at this point? Right? No chocolate. Here, I bet you they have nice chocolate. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention.
Questions? So when you have there are these phase transitions in the syrup when mm-hmm. you pour the syrup, does the velocity where when the transition happened depend on the fact that you were already pouring, so that you are changing the velocity rather than starting pouring at a specific velocity?
No, it's a it forgets its initial conditions.
Okay.
And the reason for that is it's very, very viscous. I didn't mention this, but what's interesting about this fluid mechanically is that normally you expect instabilities in fluids when the viscosity is low and the velocities are high. But here you have extremely high, you know, viscosity and very low velocities. And normally everything is very boring and laminar and slow at that limit. But here you have something else, which is called buckling. As the syrup falls from the nozzle, it extends and accelerates. But when it starts to hit the plate, it has to decelerate suddenly. So it's like taking a beam and pushing on the two ends of it, right? You would just shorten, but eventually it goes boing and falls out of the plane. So what basically happens is that the fluid feels the fact that it must, you know, turn and stop at the plate some distance from the plate, and it falls out of the plane. So initially, when it's in the catenary state, it's got a plane of symmetry, and it basically falls out of that plane, and that gives you the meandering. And that's how you understand it. You write down all the horrible equations, and then you just put them into the symmetry plane of this, and then you can perturb around that, and you can find the bifurcation and do all that kind of thing that way. That answer your question?
Yeah.
It turns out, if you know your Buckingham Pi theorem, are we speaking? No. Okay, there are five dimensionless parameters that determine the syrup. Every fluid mechanical problem can be reduced by dimensional analysis to something that depends on a few dimensionless numbers, and for this experiment, there are five. Yeah?
In the washboard road example, is there a way at the beginning, say there's an existing washboard, is there something you could do at the beginning to try to get the wheel to start bouncing on the top so that it would eventually flatten it again?
We don't know of anything, but the basic idea here is that the road is unstable. So that means if you grade the road as smooth as you possibly can, even an infinitesimal bumpiness of the road, and every gravel road is a little bit bumpy, will grow, okay? So once it's grown, the only thing you can do is change the dynamics of the way the wheel interacts with the road so that it's stable again, and then the bumps would shrink again, okay? So I always say this is a kind of engineering approach you might take to solving the washboard road problem. You might say, well, instead of saying, how can I design the suspension so the ride for the rider is smooth, independent of how bumpy the road is. That's usually how engineers approach suspension problems. You could ask instead, how should I design the suspension and the road so the combination of the road and the suspension is stable to high velocity? Then you could drive up to a higher velocity. The other way to do it is just to drive real slow, because it is stable at low speeds. Unfortunately, the practical speed is extremely low, so it's like 5 miles an hour for a real car. So in practice, everyone's driving way over the threshold speed for the instability, so it's extremely unstable. And it's almost impossible to imagine anything you could do to the suspension that would stabilize it at that spot. Yeah?
I've driven on many washboard roads.
Yes,
it seems to be a property going uphill.
It is.
Because of the instability of the hill itself?
Well, what I've shown you is the stripped down version, where we got rid of the suspension, we got rid of the wheel,
yeah.
We got rid of hills, the wheel is not driven, everything is simplified as far as possible. If you put those things back in, you change the details. And we're not interested at some level in making a realistic model of real washboard. We go to the opposite limit. How much can we rip out of the thing and still get washboard to come out? The best analogy is that of a skipping stone. If you throw a stone really slowly, buoyancy will not be enough to hold it up and will sink. If you throw it really hard, then when it touches the surface, it generates so much dynamic force that it flies up in the air. And if you throw it at just that magic speed, it'll just ski along, right? So that's how it is. That's why there's a threshold. Basically, as you go faster and faster, the dynamic forces increase like the square of the speed of the car. And so they always win in the end. They always give you enough force to throw you off the road, throw your wheel off the road. It doesn't matter if you have a fancy suspension or, in general, those forces always grow faster than like the square of the velocity. And so that's where this balancing argument that gives you the critical behavior comes from. So you basically can't win. The faster you go, the more you go to the limit where skipping is the correct thing to do. Yeah?
What are the parameters that determine the wavelength of the washboard?
The washboard depends on the velocity, and as you increase the velocity, it gets longer. And it has something to do with the flight time of the wheel according to the, the speed and the frequency come together to give you a wavelength. So that's sort of the physics of it.
So different cars driving at different speeds in the same road are going to be driving it toward a different state.
That's true, but each car only produces a very tiny amount of gravel motion. So it's wrong to think of the one person as responsible for the washboard. So really, it's only the average car that matters. And because it's such a weak function of most parameters, it doesn't really, the average doesn't even matter. It only goes like a 1/4 power of the mass of the car. Yeah?
How did the ideas for these three investigations first occur to you?
That's an interesting question. I can now admit that they occurred to me because I just saw them somewhere and I liked them. I've been interested in Washboard Road ever since I was a kid. I lived in British Columbia and we drove on a lot of Washboard Road. So I said, damn it all, I have a sabbatical, I'm going to figure this out. And so I went and tried it, and the first time we turned the experiment on, it worked. So it's direct observation of nature in that case. I was interested, I have to admit, by the theory of Platonic icicles, and I thought that's got to be wrong, so I decided to build an icicle growing machine, and just because it's kind of cool. So that, I can say, was motivated originally by a theoretical result that came out first. Actually, the theorists first studied stalactites, which are related but not quite the same problem. And stalactites are very boring to grow because they take like 100,000 years to grow. So I got into the icicles because of that. And the dribbling syrup is something that my predecessors at Cambridge had done a kind of first experiment on the dribbling syrup. But the coiling of the syrup is a classic fluid dynamical instability. There are dozens of papers. G.I. Taylor, if you know him, he worked on the coiling instability. So that's kind of a classic. So the belt version is kind of a generalization of an old classic fluid mechanics experiment. Yeah?
So I had a question. In the syrup experiment, where it goes from the point from being straight to going back and forth, that point, and then it goes from the point going back and forth to making one kind of loop, and then another loop, and another loop. How are those points the same, and how are they different? Could you say that it's kind of the same something that's being reached, or is it something
they're analogous? What they are is points where the state that you're currently in loses stability, and a new state becomes the branch that you go to. So what people would usually say is, well, this whole system has many possible states. So you can picture a kind of whole bunch of branches on a tree, but only some of those states, and sometimes more than one under the same parameters, are stable, and other states are unstable. So in other words, the straight state is still there, it's still a solution of the the problem. But if you ever made it at high speed, it would, tiniest perturbations around that would grow. That's like I was ragging him about the Leaning Tower. If you take into account the direction of the perturbations, then they break the symmetry. But without the perturbations, without the infinitesimal perturbations of the noise of the experiment, that's a perfectly symmetric state. That's like the pencil balancing on its point. It will not fall, right? But in real life, there's always fluctuations, in this case, thermal fluctuations or just experimental fluctuations. And that state becomes unstable at that critical value of the belt speed. And it also depends on the nozzle height and things like the viscosity and the surface tension and the density. Okay.
But each time when it goes from each time it's like a loss of stability.
Correct.
That creates a different system. So
yes.
That way they're the same.
Yes.
Right.
Let's see if I back up. Oops, that's the wrong way. There are multi-stable states. So you might notice here that there's both blue and red on top of each other. What that means is if I come from this direction, it meanders till I get to about here. If I come up from below, it coils till I get to about here. So in this little region, which is kind of a triangle shape here, there's actually a bistable region. So there are two branches, one coiling and one meandering. And the which one you get depends on which you head first. So there's historical, history dependent. That's called hysteresis. And there's a lot of hysteresis in the higher states.
So this hysteresis, if you kind of, continue the experiment so that it went further to the right, would that then kind of work itself out, do you think,
it gets more and more complex.
And
it gets more complex in this direction for a simple physical reason. Down here, the frequency of the meandering is quite slow. As you lift the nozzle up, the frequency goes up very fast, and eventually it begins resonating with the pendulum frequency, so the frequency that the thread would wiggle at. So way up here somewhere, over here, basically the whole thread would be wiggling in a complicated pendulum multiple mode state, and the tip would be driving this wiggling chain. Imagine a chain hanging you know, it's just wiggling at the bottom end. So because there's an infinity of, you know, of modes as you go to higher and higher height, this is going to just get more and more complex in that direction. And there could be many states overlapping, including chaotic states. As soon as you have three or four modes, they can interact chaotically, and there's no reason for it to be periodic or anything.
Right.
I think
we have time for one more question.
Yeah? For the washboard road, would it preserve the road to have tracked vehicles that would distribute the weight? Or
what's interesting is the answer is no. And it turns out that snowmobiles have their own washboard. It's much longer wavelength than a car, but it's well known to snowmobilers that snowmobile tracks, you know, have moguls on them. There's also something known as a whoop-de-doo or a whoops, which is a motocross effect. And you've seen motocross guys come flying over these bumps. Those bumps are emergent, okay? You start with a flat motocross track and it grows the whoops automatically. There's ripples on railway tracks, very fine wavelength, but very low amplitude, because it's steel, after all. So if you, next time you're in Toronto at college and Spadina, there's a whole lot of crisscrossing railway tracks. Just look at them, and you'll see that they're corrugated, as the engineers would say. And when you hear the streetcar go over them, they go roar. So they're called roaring rails by the railway engineers. So it's a very general phenomenon. As soon as you have one thing rolling on another, it has normal forces that increase as you go up faster, eventually they hop off. Right? It's, you know, the fingernails on the blackboard, or the wiping your finger on a wet window, or all those things. Stick slip, or those kind of things are all related to the phenomenon.
Okay. Let's thank you.
Thank you.